Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Bijal Shah, MD, MS, an associate member in the Department of Malignant Hematology at Moffitt Cancer Center, and Michael Wong, MD, a professor in the Department of Lymphoma and Myeloma at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, to highlight optimal approaches to CAR T-cell therapy administration and management of associated toxicities in patients with hematologic malignancies. In our exclusive interview, Shah and Wong discuss the management of cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity, the referral process, and the need for academic and community collaboration for CAR T-cell therapy and hematologic malignancies.
When I think about CAR T-cell therapy, I always think broadly about cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity as sort of the, you know, the toxicities that define this therapy. Does that make sense to you? And how do you think about the management broadly when we talk about these side effects?
So I think the main concern, the most famous and typical toxicities are CRS and neurotoxicity. So whenever we talk about the CAR T-cell toxicity, or we call it CAR tox, we talk about the CRS and the neurotoxicity. With the time, our knowledge with CAR T efficacy and toxicity grow, and we learn that another category of complications could be early, immediate, and or later would be the infection complications. We think that the CAR T cells further enhance the B cell aplasia, compromising the humoral and also cellular immunities, and the opportunistic and regular infections would continue to show up and sometimes kill our patients. So we, in addition to CRS and neurotoxicity, we're thinking about the infections. And of course, the toxicities are also include other categories as well. And we are started learning about this. We also began to realize that we need to be careful with the cardiac toxicities. We need to be careful with other issues. The toxicity is in the real practice when you take care of a CAR T cell patient is very broad. But yes, I totally think that agree that CRS and the neurotoxicity are the things that come to mind immediately when you talk about the CAR tox.
One of the things that we've been doing here is intervening earlier with tocilizumab, in some cases even corticosteroids, really as the CRS is emerging. So more specifically, as we start moving from grade one, which is typically just a little bit of fever, into grade two now, where we're having to do these, you know, IV fluid boluses for emerging hypotension. For us here, that's been our cue to start thinking about using, you know, interventions like tocilizumab to target interleukin 6 receptor, corticosteroids. Have you found that to be helpful in treating your CAR T-cell patients as well? Are there other tricks you've learned along the way?
You know, in the beginning, we are always very scared when we take care of the CAR T-cell patient. Number one, we don't want to start the steroids too early, because everybody knows from what we learned from school, the steroids antagonize the immune system. So we don't want to use steroids too early to antagonize the efficacy and the expansion of the CAR T-cells. And then we also did not want to wipe out the fever immediately, because maybe fever is part of the cytokine release and we don't want to dim the cytokine levels. So, but later on, we realized that if we do it too late, then our patients really suffer and they have, you know, CRS, high fevers up to 40s, hypotension, hypoxia, and some of them have to go to the ICU to get on the pressors. And sometimes we have to intubate them for the hypoxia. And also, if we don't intervene too early, then the neurotoxicity, when the CRS is really bad, this neurotoxicity also is very bad and follows the CRS and sometimes seizures, you know, and late toxicities. And then we started to using the steroids a little more liberal, and we found out that later on, steroids did antagonize some of the efficacy of the CAR Ts. This is published in large cell lymphoma, high dose steroids leads to lower efficacy. So I think we, with time, our experience and our learning curve with time improves our therapy, our judgment of the when to the timing when to use this. And it's a delicate balance. You cannot use too early, you cannot use it too late. So I think masters like you and would really know the timing of the therapy. So why don't you share with some of your wisdom and your experience?
Well, you know, I think it's what you said. It's a balance. You know, if you push too much with the steroids, you're exactly right. You are going to impact the CAR T cells. I think if you push too early with steroids, and this is still being tested, but my concern is if you push too early with steroids before the T cells have really had a chance to begin expanding and to begin that cytotoxic cascade of clearing the lymphomas, you might actually interfere with the efficacy. On the other hand, you know, when I talk about earlier use of corticosteroids, we're talking about very punctuated doses, one or two rounds of 10 milligrams of dexamethasone and stopping. And so a classic regimen for us will be tocilizumab, 10 milligrams of dex given every 12 hours, and then we watch and we make sure that the CRS is improving. We make sure that people aren't getting sicker. The challenge for us, it has been neurotoxicity. How do you manage it? You know, tocilizumab has no real benefit there. And so we've really been focused on the use of steroids and they work, but the, you know, sometimes the minute you pull the brakes on the steroids and you, you know, try to ensure that the individual is getting better, well, the neurotoxicity gets worse again. And so you find yourself kind of having to string along with additional steroids. And we know that that may come again with prolonged use of those steroids, some impact on the CAR T cell efficacy. But I don't know that there's an easy answer. We don't want patients to get to the point where they're going to be intubated, where they're going to get sick. And we certainly don't want to leave patients in a situation where they're going to become weaker as a consequence of both the inflammation now and the corticosteroids that we're administering. Otherwise, that leads to the need for rehabilitation and so on the back end. And so it's this fine balance of giving the steroids when we have to and really pulling away when we haven't. Out of curiosity, Michael, how do you explain this to patients? I know this is always a hard thing when we start throwing around terminology like CRS and neurotox. What's your strategy for helping that patient who's in front of you say, look, there's some scary stuff we see, but most people are going to get better?
When dealing with CAR tox, still about 2% of people has actually, you know, mortality rate from that. So I always taking it very seriously. So I always gather the patient, the spouse, and even the younger family. I demand the whole family discuss the situation, discuss the pros and the cons of CAR T cells therapy. First of all, the toxicity could be fatal in rare times, but even if it's not fatal, could be severe. The family need to realize that. And the whole family need to vote on, everybody should have a voice. And you know, the benefit is that it's a life-saving therapy, and it could be, even the very most refractory lymphomas could be put into a long-term remission. So benefit and cost, right? So I want to involve the whole family, especially the younger family, because one of my patient was intubated. The wife forgot what I said, and was really emotional distress. So the younger family came to what's going on with my dad, mom? What did you tell me? So I learned the lesson from then. I involved the whole family. So the family, so that they, you know, sometimes when the patient in the ICU intubated, they would not, you know, be totally caught by surprise. And, but, you know, we also need to explain the reality that you really wanted to tell them, what is the CRS? What does it mean? what am I going to do? And what is the neurotoxicity? If the patient is not able to recognize the surroundings, the family members, should we panic? Explain all this to prevent them for them to settle in their heart what would be happening so that they would react properly.
I mean, one of the most distressing things, even as someone who's done many, many, many CAR T cell therapies, is that neurotoxicity. And it has this very typical cadence. It begins with some degree of word-finding difficulty. It then progresses to some degree of somnolence where, the individual is more tired, and then usually progresses to the point of what we call broadly encephalopathy. And we have many different terms for that. But that encephalopathy most commonly is, the person is there, but you can talk to them, you can interact with them, and you're not going to get much in response. And the scary thing for us is, is that going to spill over into more serious consequences like seizures and the like? And thankfully, that's very rare. We haven't really seen that to any meaningful degree, but it can happen. Sometimes that normal cadence that I described takes a slightly different turn. We've seen agitation in some cases instead of the somnolence and the sort of more broadly, difficulty with interaction. And so those can be challenging scenarios. As I mentioned, steroids tends to help out considerably. The hardest part is understanding when to, take the brakes off the steroids. What Michael said was fantastic. Involving the family is so critical. And as many of the family members as you can get, it's often not easy to get everyone in a single room, but trying to make sure that people know what to expect, that nope, there's no guarantee that we'll see any of this, but it can happen. And if it does happen, these are the things that you can expect, and we'll do our best to clear it up. As Michael also pointed out, the likelihood of dying from these complications, whether we're talking about the cytokine release syndrome or the neurologic side effects, is exceptionally rare. It's about 2%. So, we're fortunate that we're armed with the knowledge that, as scary as it is, both for us as well as the patients and family, most people really are going to recover fully. And so, we want to make sure that we do what we can to manage that disease, which we believe poses a much graver threat.
We explained to them that CRS could be totally handled by tocilizumab and also steroids and any many other measures, and it would not have residual damage. And neurotoxicity, I totally agree with Dr. Shah. Even in the worst cases, there could be no remnant of the neurotoxicities for the vast majority of the times. So you, a lot of people, I remember one patient have a brain edema, and the family asked me, Dr. Wong, can my dad wake up and still practice law? And he's exactly what he's doing now. I mean, he had, for that kind of a severe neurotoxicity, he has no residual toxicity at all.
Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. Michael, how do referral patterns work for you guys at MD Anderson when we're talking about CAR T cell immunotherapy? I mean, one of the challenges is having to, be in the same place to receive that therapy and then to be monitored usually for about a month or so. How does that cooperation work between, the community practices and a major center like MD Anderson?
So we really, we ask them to stay around for about either in the hospital or nearby for 2 to 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. Depending their toxicities. If they have a very significant history in the hospital, we would certainly keep them a little longer. But we have no problem collaborating. After that, we have no problem collaborating with the community about managing them.
One of the challenges that we run into, and you've spoken a lot about this, is what's referred to as the high-risk variant of mantle cell. These are our blastoid TP53 mutant variants of mantle, so that really can grow very, very explosively. And trying to identify those patients early and trying to ensure that we're thinking about what we're going to do, particularly when we talk about management, you know, therapy like CAR T-cell immunotherapy that involves an apheresis step, a bridging step before we can get to the therapy, and really trying to communicate with our community oncologists, our referring oncologists, so that they recognize that not all mantle cell is created alike. We spent a long time educating about indolent mantle cell. We did all this work to say, look, oh, you know, there's some mantle cell that is not bad and you can watch it, it's okay and it's safe. But now I feel like I'm on the other side saying, well, but don't forget, there are some bad cases too.
Okay. That's why it makes it so complicated. You know, the thing is that not only mantle cell lymphoma, follicular lymphoma, an indolent disease, also have high risk patients. And large cell lymphoma, on the other hand, is very aggressive, but you need to cure some of them, right? So the communication with the community is always very difficult. There's no way around it. We just tell them again and again and again, you know, here, what is the markers? What is the definition for the indolent disease? You know, what is high-risk disease? Exactly like blastoid, pleomorphic, PI6 over 50%, complex karyotype, P53 mutation, deletion. So those patients, you repeatedly telling them, and I think the whole message gets across not to 100%, but it's time you educate and you share knowledge. There's always improvement.
Have you found a way to integrate primary care physicians in this network of care? I mean, you mentioned a lot about management of, you know, B cell deficiency, hypogammaglobulinemia, and even to some degree T cell lymphopenia and sort of the impaired immunity after CAR T cell therapy.
I frequently measure the immunoglobulin practiced in every post-CAR T patient. If they're low, I would really on the watch out to give them IVIGs. Mm-hmm. If they have one infection, I would do that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you start monthly, you can gradually, taper it every 3 or 4 months, say 6 months. So I use that very freely because we spend so much effort and resources to rescue a patient's life, then the patient's, you know, killed by infection that can be prevented. I feel that that's really, you know, we should take this very seriously and do the IVIG. IVIG is very expensive, but, you know, our first priority is to save the life. So I use that at a very low threshold.
We do the same thing, and I have to say honestly that in trying to engage primary care is not been as much of a priority, you know. And I say I hadn't even thought about it, you know, until you know this discussion. What can we do to bring the primary care doctors back into it? And this goes beyond even CAR T cell immunotherapy. When you know you probably have the same experience when someone gets a diagnosis of lymphoma, all of a sudden everything else goes by the wayside and you become that patient's primary care doctor, their oncologist, their everythingologist. And it can be, a little bit cumbersome, but it would be phenomenal to try and bring the primary care doctor into this for simple things, as you pointed out, to make sure that we're following their heart function, to make sure that we're following, you know, the recovery of those immune globulins and supporting them as best we can, in addition to their community oncologist. But I think definitely a lot that we can grow from recognizing just how big this you know the medical system is.
There's gaps in our communication. So many times I give my personal phone and my email to the CAR T patients. So that I found very very useful because in the middle of the night they show up in the ER and they have high fevers and the doctor don't know what to do. You tell them, this is a CAR T cell patient. If he has COVID, he has to get this, don't get send him home and all that. So in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock, if you don't, become the all of sudden a lifeline. Otherwise, the other side don't know what to do. So I think those kind of, eventually, I think we should have some kind of on call for the CAR T cell patients eventually. And, you know, this is complicated by the ongoing pandemic. It makes, you know, many, unfortunately, I lost quite some patients when they're lymphoma in remission, including post-CAR T patients. That's really very painful and very tragic, very sad. So in order to prevent this, the communication between academic and community is ever more important.
I've shared the same experience, and it's heartbreaking to see someone who's in continuous molecular remission from their mantle cell lymphoma for years, only to see them succumb to a COVID infection is terrible. You know, and we have, you know, tried to be very aggressive, you know, including vaccinations. I don't know how well they work, but vaccinations following CAR T cell immunotherapy, IVIG, the prophylactic in some cases, antibodies, so the thinking of the Regeneron and those other cocktail antibodies, but we try to be very aggressive. One of my victories, actually, you wouldn't believe it, Michael. I mean, she's in her 70s, mantle cell lymphoma. She had no B cells, no T cells, still recovering her counts and got COVID. But we were aggressive with IVIG. We were aggressive with the monoclonals, and she recovered without a single symptom. So
congratulations. That's really
I think the advantage, though, was she was here, as you pointed out. And you know, as our patients get further and further from the cancer center, the ability to manage that, as you pointed out, even if they have your cell phone and your email, the ability to manage that patient in the moment is very complicated. I think trying to build these partnerships is going to be even more critical given the COVID pandemic and given, I mean, it's not just COVID. I mean, it's everything, all the infections that can potentially manifest as these individuals recover their blood counts and recover their immune system function. How are you going to make CAR T cell better?
That's a $1 million question, Dr. Shah. How to make the CAR T cell better? There's so many strategies. Number one, a lot of them are focused on the CAR T cell construct. We are using second generation CAR T cells. So there's a third generation, fourth generation, sixth, fifth generation of ever complicating constructs of the CAR T cells. There's, you know, the constructs mainly can engage in the more co-stimulation molecules, involve IL-2 receptors, involve the dominant knockout checkpoint inhibitors, and many strategies, including bispecific dual CARs, random CAR, tandem CARs, and tri-specific CARs. Okay, there's also, as you know, NK T cells, and there's also you know, the many efforts. This is not only limited to getting the autologous the cell resources from the CAR T cell construct is major, and then where are we going to get the cells? So now we're using predominantly autologous cells, T cells, and then we are looking into cord blood T cells. So we're looking at a feed pharmaceutical approach, you know, that using stem cells to derive that into T cells, so NK cells, NK T cells, many, and then we are using combination therapies and adding with the BTK inhibitors, Revlimid, so many of them. So we are in the CAR T cell era, and CAR T cell therapy so far is the only therapy that could cause a long-term refractory relapse patient into a long-term remission. Only therapy, no therapy else, chemotherapy, target therapies, even bispecific antibodies, monoclonal antibodies could achieve this. So I guess Dr. Shah, you and I are really, are working in a very exciting time. And congratulations to the recent leadership in the AOL FDA approval, major contribution to the field, and also major contribution to the CAR T cell field and to the patients. So.
And to your work in mantle cell, Michael, not just CAR T, but extending well beyond CAR T cell therapy. And, you know, the reason we can talk about BTKs and the reason we can talk about Revlimid and these other approaches is a reflection, I think, of a lot of work that you've done as well. I think that it is an exciting time. And it's exciting because none of what we've said use the chemotherapy word. We're really moving into a chemo-free era, and I couldn't be more excited. And hearing you talk about all the new cellular therapy approaches, it's amazing because I'm really looking forward to taking all of the chemotherapy out of the equation, curing patients with CAR T-cell immunotherapy on day one. And I hope that one day, I actually have no doubt that one day we'll get there.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.